I'm a grateful alcoholic. My name is George.
George.
I'd like to start this meeting with another moment of silence, and because one, I'm not here yet, and I'm waiting for God to catch up to me here. My head's all over the place, and I want to take that moment of silence for James L. because he's been an integral part of a lot of people's lives, and one of the things my sponsor, when he was going home, and I like to use that expression, he said, "As long as you carry him in your heart, carry me in your heart, and you speak about me, I'll never be gone." And I want everybody to carry James in their heart today and speak about him, because that way he'll stay in this room and in rooms like this from people like us. Thank you. I want to review a little bit of where we are, because for 2 weeks, the first week I did a lot of information about the history, and last week I told some stories and talked a lot about the first tradition. And if you're anything like I was, these last 2 weeks you're very confused about what's going on, because there's a lot of information and it's really not falling together yet. It's going to take a while for a lot of us for the unity part to fall together. I want to read the, first of all, I want to start with the long tradition, the long form of our first tradition, which says each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of the great whole. A must continue to live, or most of us will surely die. Hence, our common welfare comes first, but individual welfare follows closely afterward. I want to review that first tradition a little bit. I want to talk about what Bill called our tradition. One, he called it a benign anarchy, because in the first tradition, we're saying we have no authorities, but yet is authority in these rooms. There's two authorities that run Alcoholics Anonymous. One of them, they told me, was love, and the other was alcohol. And those are the two authorities that we talk about. Later on, we'll talk about love. We'll talk about alcohol and a loving God. So those are the two authorities that we are. They tell us there are no musts in the first traditions, but there's a lot of there ought to be's. There are no musts, but a lot of ought to be's. And we read the 12 and 12, we talk about a guy by the name of Eddie Rickenbacker. Now, you know, I mentioned some stories last week about Gladys, and we talked about Florence, and we talked about Marty Mann, and I want to talk about Eddie Rickenbacker. Now, when I got my 12 and 12, and I was told to read the first, you know, tradition, I read it, and I didn't know who Eddie Rickenbacker was. And if I asked anybody in this room, there'll be very few people who knew who Eddie Rickenbacker was and what he accomplished and what he did. He was just very quietly mentioned. There's a guy by the name of Hogan who was a golfer that's mentioned in Bill's story. There's a lot of people that did a lot of great things that were mentioned very quietly. And anonymity means to do things without names. So I figured let's talk about Eddie Rickenbacker a little bit. Eddie Rickenbacker, his nickname was Fast Eddie or Eddie. He was served in the United States Army Air Service. He was ranked a major. He was a World War I pilot and very well decorated. He was awarded the Medal of Honor. He got the Distinguished Service Cross 7 times. He was a World War I Victory Medal. He got the Legion of Honor and the Crux de Gras, I guess is the way you would say it. His other accomplishments was he was a championship car racer. He started the Rickenbacker Car Company, which was a bust, but he also started Indianapolis Speedway, just one of those things. He was a government consultant in military matters, and he was a pioneer in air transportation. He was also the longtime head of Eastern Airlines. So, you know, Bill, with his history of people, was very good. You know, in the story it says, we were like Eddie Rickenbacker, stuck on the raft, lost, you know, and we shared equally, and we were afraid that we were going to rock the boat, is what they talk about. During World War II, he carried special assignments for Harry Stimson, who was the Secretary of War. In October of 1942, while flying a B-17 over the Pacific on a mission to Douglas MacArthur, his plane went down in the Pacific. For 22 days, he and a whole bunch of other people rode a raft. One man died during that. But what they did do is they shared everything equally. He was the oldest man on that raft, and he lost 54 pounds, but he lived, and everybody shared everything equally. And that's where we talk about the unity. So that Eddie Rickenbacker story, which is very short in our literature, is very powerful to what unity is all about. And, you know, the defects, and I want to read something out of 12 and 12, and I'm going to go over the AA checklist, go over to Tradition 1, and then go right into Tradition 2, because there's some rich stories in Tradition 2. It says, implicit throughout AA traditions is the confession that our fellowship has its sins. We confess that we have character defects as a society, and that these defects threaten us continually. Our traditions are a guide to better ways of working and living, and they are an antidote for the various maladies. The 12 traditions are a group of survival and harmony that AAA's steps are for each member, sobriety and peace of mind. But the 12 traditions also point straight to our individual defects. By implication, they ask that each lay aside pride and resentment. They ask for personal as well as group sacrifice. They ask that we never use AA's name in a quest for personal power or distinction or money. The traditions guarantee that equality of all members and the independence of all groups. They show how we may best relate ourselves to each other in the world outside. They indicate that how we can best function in harmony as the great whole, for the sake of the welfare of the entire society. The traditions ask that every individual in every group and every area of Alcoholics Anonymous shall lay aside all desires, ambitions, and unwanted actions that could bring serious division among us or lose for us the confidence of the world at large. The 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous symbolize the sacrificial character of our life together, as they are the greatest force for unity that we know. If we go from there, you know, and going over all those stories, how does that make us unified? Well, I believe the traditions infiltrated my life much differently. The steps, I did a lot of work, and I was brought to my attention what my character defects were through a sponsor, and the defects that really come up in the traditions, the one that we got to keep on top, they call it, Bill called it self-righteous indignation. And that really has to do with fear, pride, and anger. And we got to keep those on top, because those are the things that will kill a group, will kill an individual, and kill our society as it pertains to us, as surviving as a fellowship, as it did to many others. Here are the questions, because, you know, in our traditions it says, in our 12 and 12 it says that each AA member has practiced the 12 steps and 12 traditions to the best of his ability, he will turn around and use those principles to get a better life. And it says these traditions and steps work for people whether they're alcoholic or not. Now, I had no principles when I got here. And as I stayed here, my sponsor said the traditions have to do with relationships. First, it's my relationship with myself, then the one I had with God, and then the one I had with you guys. And then after that, it was God, you guys, and then me. I became least important in it, and that was how I started relationships with others. In our eighth step, it talks about defective relationships with other human beings. And when I walk into a group, I was the defective relationship when I got here. So as I stayed here and I did the work necessary through the steps, and the steps, the traditions, they say, are nothing more than a continuation of the steps in a group setting. So here are some of the questions that we can ask ourselves. Of how we relate to the group, and even if we want to bring it to our home life or to our significant other life, you can ask yourself these questions. Tradition one, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. Am I a group, am I in my group a healer, mending, integrating person, or am I divisive? What about gossip and taking other members' inventories? Am I a peacemaker, or do I, with porous prejudices, such as just for the sake of discussion, plunge into argument? Am I gentle with those who rub me the wrong way, or am I abrasive? Do I make competitive AA remarks, such as comparing one group to another, or contrasting AA in one place with AA in another place? Do I put down some AA activities if they were superior for not practicing in this or that aspect of AA? Am I informed about AA as a whole? Do I support in every way I can AA as a whole, or just parts I understand and approve of? Am I considerate of AA members as I want them to be of me? Do I support platitudes about love, indulging in and secretly justifying behavior that bristles with hostility? Do I go to enough AA meetings or read enough AA literature to really keep in touch? Do I share with AA all of me, the good and the bad, accepting as well as giving the help of the fellowship? I mean, those are pretty good questions to ask in any relationship with anybody I'm with, whether it be a male or a female or a sponsee or a sponsor or just in general of what's going on in my life, my family, you know. And when I can answer these questions and answer them honestly, I will start understanding what unity really means. Now, understanding a little bit what that unity means, it brings me to tradition too. For our group purpose, there's an ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they don't govern. That's pretty hard sometimes in some of the groups we go to because some people who think they run the meeting, they own the meeting, they are AA, but they're not. They're just a servant. The best any one of us will ever be in Alcoholics Anonymous is a member. That's the best we'll ever get. And then if we're lucky enough to be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous, we can become a servant. And that's what we do when we stand up here, whether it be me or someone else doing steps or traditions. We're serving the fellowship that was people who served us that we're giving back. I want to talk about my favorite two people in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's called the Bleeding Deacon and the Elder Statesman. And they tell me in our literature that every Bleeding Deacon, every Elder Statesman at one time was a Bleeding Deacon. What is a Bleeding Deacon? What is an Elder Statesman? Well, a Bleeding Deacon is a guy that comes in to a new area and talks about it in our 12 and 12. It talks about it in AA Comes of Age. About a guy who comes into an area. There's no AA meeting, so he starts an AA meeting. He's rents out the hall, he becomes the big shot, he becomes the sole person of Alcoholics Anonymous in that area. He puts his friend in a position of power, and as time goes on, the group gets tired of him. They're tired of his antics, and they kind of rebel, because that's one of the things we do. And in their rebellion, they turn around and they ask for an election. And in that election, the old timer is moved out of office. And that old timer is very upset. Now, that old timer can be so upset that he gets to the point where alcohol looks good and he goes out and gets drunk, or he becomes what they call an elder statesman. And the elder statesman just sits back and lets the group grow without him being in control. It's called letting go of control. And those elder statesmen are the guys that really carry AA's message. They're the guys that sit in the back of the room when I got here and I thought they were sleeping and I didn't know what serenity looked like, but they were at peace. And whenever the group went, they just said, don't drink, go to meetings. What the hell does that mean? Don't drink and go to meetings. How's that going to keep me sober? Or this was going on in a group, and I would think of back to a business meeting at a group down the road here that I got sober in, and they were arguing over what color the rug should be. And this argument went on for 6 months. It was a second floor building, and some people know the room. And first it was going to be blue, then it was going to be red, and there was an argument. They put a whole committee together, and they're arguing back and forth. And eventually they decided that the rug was going to be green, and the next week we found out we had no more room. Because we were so involved in fighting over what color a rug should be, we forgot what we were supposed to be doing for Alcoholics Anonymous and carrying that message to the alcoholic who was suffering. So, you know, those Bleeding Deacons who wanted things a certain way, I hear about Gucci rooms, I hear about low-bottom rooms. There's no such thing to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Every room is a room where when you walk in, hope is carried if I listen and relate myself. You know, we get to the second tradition, and we talk about Bill's lightning experience that he had on, it was 1947, we'll go back in the backwards time clock, involved with Charlie Towns at Charlie Towns Hospital, and Charlie Towns came up with a great idea because he was thrown out of his house on Clinton Street. People were coming over for nothing, and he was offered a position as a lay therapist at Towns Hospital. And he was going to get a drawer, and he was going to make profits on it. Charlie Towns showed him all the profits, and he was in his mind already taking Lois out of the kitchen and having meetings in Madison Square Garden. This was all going through his head. And on the train, he kept saying, well, you know, it is ethical, and I know Lois is going to be thrilled about this. And he gets home, and he goes, talks to Lois, and Lois tells him in no certain terms she wasn't thrilled about it. He didn't understand why she wasn't happy about this. And there was a meeting of his group that night, and he went to the group, and he started carrying on this conversation about, you know, that it's ethical, and you know, the group got involved in it, and what ended up starting to happen is the group started to give their own rendition of his own words. And he said, yes, it's ethical, but it's not something we can do. The second tradition started coming into play right then, and you know, he said, you know, but the labor is worthy of his hire. He heard that in his head. And he said, you know, Bill, aren't you the one who once said, do not settle for the good in spite of the best? Can't settle for the good in spite of the best. And this is, even though this is good, we can't ally with hospitals in these places. Other traditions were being put into place during this conversation. And the group, which started very meekly at that point, started growing in their power. And it talks about it in the 12 and 12. It talks about it in AA Comes of Age. It talks about it throughout our literature. And as we stuck here and we started, and it started hearing it, he started saying, you know, I finally agreed with the group, and the group was right and I was wrong. And tradition two, it says, sooner or later, every AA comes to depend on a power greater than himself. He finds that God, of his understanding, is not only a source of strength, but also a source of positive direction. Realizing that some fraction of this infinite resource is now available, his life takes on an entirely different complexion. His experiences, he experienced a new inner security together with such a sense of destiny and purpose he had never known before. As each day passes, our AA's reviews his mistakes. He learns from his daily experience what his remaining character defects are and becomes ever more willing to have them removed. You know, I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1994, and I was a defiant little brat. I stamped my feet. I wanted what I wanted. And I would walk into a meeting, and they would be talking about God. And I was in a smoking room, and I would go outside for a cigarette. And Bob Welsh, who's no longer with us, used to say, George, I don't care if you bounce off these walls, but you do not leave this room from prayer to prayer. And I used to do it. And one day he got mad at me. He says, I want you to sit down and watch what happens at a meeting when someone raises their hand and brings up a subject and then walks out the door. And I started doing that. And somebody would raise their hand, they'd bring up the subject, like in their halfway house, somebody wasn't taking out the garbage, exactly what was on my mind at the moment, you know. And then, you know, he'd walk out the door, and you'd hear this whole bunch of good solution. And as soon as he walked back in the room changed. That was a loving God as he was expressing himself. I believe that when I sit in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I sit in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous to hear God speak through people. I believe my God has skin. That's something I always say today. So when I sit in a room and I watch how many times somebody, good meeting, bad meeting, meeting's a meeting. There's no such thing as a good or bad meeting to me anymore. Even the bad meetings, something good can come out of. And usually what comes out of what we call a bad meeting is somebody's not in the solution, somebody else is not in the solution, somebody else is not in the solution. All of a sudden somebody is called on and they raise their hand and the meeting turns around. Right at that moment, God comes into this room and changes the meeting. And then you hear nothing but solution. And that's the loving God we talk about in this room that I was taught to look for as I sat in these rooms. Now, that's not how I came in here, because I was one of those guys that we talked about being argumentative and defiant and rebellious and wanted to be right instead of being happy. All the stuff that I was learning in the steps, I was now learning to see through the traditions. The second tradition, when I got here, the people who showed me that hope, you know, I like to talk about, the second step in line with the second tradition, that there is a loving God that I saw in these rooms through people who sat in these rooms that were genuinely happy, no matter what was going on. They were meeting those calamities that were going on in life with this serenity that I had no idea what was going on, and no matter what was coming down the pike, they were happy about it. They seemed to be in the room, and I didn't believe they were honestly happy. I thought they were going out and getting drunk after the meeting, because my perception was that warped. As I stayed here, and I saw that they were really happy, and they were transcending those troubles, whether it be a loss of someone they loved, whether it be a divorce or an illness, they would come in here and talk about solution. And other people who were in these rooms already had that solution. What a wonderful gift was to watch God work through the rooms and watch people who were miserable start to light up. God was always working the room. I wasn't paying attention to God when I got here. So, And then a guy by the name of Jack Norris in the early days, now it's my little experience when I got here, Jack Norris, who also heard Bill in 1940, suggested that Bill do a couple of things. He described the occasion of a meeting in Rochester. The place was packed and everyone worshipped Bill. He owed those, a lot of people owed their life, they said, to the happiness that Bill brought them. And you can see the emotional tones of the meeting. And that's what we talk about where I saw a loving God. The emotional tones of the meeting. When I walked into a room and there were certain people in the room and who touched my heart in a way that no one else could because of their genuineness, their heart, what was going on in their heart and how they brought it out in such a loving way to someone who is unlovable. That is a wonderful way to watch God work, to watch a newcomer come in here who is miserable, looking down and doesn't know how to look up, to see them start to smile, to see the love that the fellowship gives them to bring them around. I can tell you time after time of the many operations I've been through that every time I woke up, someone from Alcoholics Anonymous was in my bed in the hospital. I know there's a couple of people we know that right now are in the hospital. A friend of mine a couple of weeks ago fell from a bike. People showed up for him or people called him up. Another person I know right now is in the intensive care unit in another hospital. AA is there. It's a big poster that's the size of our sheets over here that have the 12 steps signed with everybody that's come up into the waiting room who can't even go in to see him because he's in intensive care. And that's just, you know, what people are doing. AA shows up. And that's the love of this fellowship we talk about in that second tradition. What ended up happening is that he asked, every group follows the same cycle of development that each of us as individuals follow. There are groups that start out, and you know, I believe God does two things with the group. He either lets it grow or he shuts it down. There's a couple of us who've been around and heard, saw groups that started and there was no loving God in there. There was a lot of personalities and no principles, and eventually you see the door shut and that group doesn't exist anymore. But it's amazing how another group opens up because God has a need for it somewhere else. But I've watched many rooms, many groups close, and I've watched other groups grow and grow and grow. I'm sitting in here, and Jay said to me at the beginning of the meeting, look at this. This is a traditions meeting. Isn't this amazing? Look how many people are sitting in a traditions meeting. When I used to go to traditions meeting, if you had three people, you had a lot. You know, it's amazing to see so many people sitting here. And I know it's not me that they're here for. They're here to learn something. it talks about a lot of people think that Alcoholics Anonymous, to some extent, is a new form of the human society. In our discussion of the first tradition, we emphasize that AA has no authority because each AA of necessity has a sensitive and responsive conscience, and because alcohol will discipline him if he backslides. We have those two authorities. You know, we come in here, and I don't feel lovable. I don't feel love. I can tell you that the first time I really felt part of Alcoholics Anonymous was when I was sitting in a meeting, and I must have been here for a bunch of weeks, and I started laughing for the first time, and it was a real genuine laugh. That's where God was starting to change me, and I didn't know it at the time. We are finding that little need for mandated rules or regulation. Despite the fact that we do veer off on tangents, we are become more able to depend absolutely on long-time stability of the AA group itself. There's certain groups I go to get. I go to a meeting. I was here this afternoon because there's a whole lot of recovery in it. And it's not because of the number of years of recovery. It's because of the quality of recovery that I go for. There's certain groups that I go to give because they're new and they're growing, and there's a lot of young people who are, and when I say young, I don't mean in age, I mean young in recovery. There's a lot of young people and they haven't been down the path, and there's only a few people, and it's too much of a burden for one person or a couple of people to be responsible to a whole group. This is where we start breaking up and letting everybody be responsible for a small part of a greater whole. Coffee makers, greeters, all those things is God speaking through us. Literature meetings, all of that is a way that through AA that there's a loving God as he's expressing himself in the conscience of each group. This particular group does steps and then traditions. Sometimes they do history. Once in a while they do concepts. All that is part of this group's conscience. This group has grown a lot since its inception. The group this afternoon in the same meeting place started in 1994. I was talking to one of the members today. When I used to come here, there was 8 of us, maybe 10 of us. And that's around 16 years now it's coming up on. And I've watched that room. You can't come in here on an afternoon. There's a meeting down at Central House that on a Friday night you can't walk in. It's a double-digit meeting. So there are many different types of meetings. And, you know, and God speaks in every one of those meetings. I have not missed a meeting where God hasn't showed up. I may sit in that meeting and I may not show up. And I might not be listening to listen to God as it talks about our second step, that God is there if we relate ourselves to Him. I had a lot of problem with that whole God consciousness of the second step, the loving God. What are leaders and what are trusted servants? A trusted servant is somebody who sits up here and gets put in the barrel for a month, 6 months, 9 months for a commitment, whether it be a GSR or he be a intergroup rep or he be working over in the intergroup office as a volunteer, he be a coffee maker, he be washing toilet bowls or setting up chairs. They're all equal. And once we walk in here, we are all equal. You know, that second tradition talks about a lot of good things. Let me pull it up, because I did pull it out. I do know that. It says, no AA can compel another to do anything, and nobody can be punished or expelled. That talks about that in our first tradition. And I came in here using the third tradition to speak about what was ever on my mind. Not to be part of, but to be apart from, so I could get thrown out of the room, so I can go get high, because that's what I wanted to do, a drunk. The AA member has to conform to the principles of recovery. That's the steps. I had to conform to those principles first, because if I didn't conform to the principles of recovery, then I wouldn't have stayed here. I did it first because I was afraid. Then I did it because I was told I needed to. And eventually I did it because I liked the way that discipline was going. I was starting to get happy. I was starting to be a part of a fellowship that when I got here, didn't want to be part of. If his life actually depends on obedience to spiritual principle. If he deviates too far, the penalty is sure and swift. He sickens and dies. And I was afraid, not of dying, I was afraid of going out there and picking up a drink and living. And not being able to get back here, knowing what I know in here. One of the things I used to hear people say, a head full of AA and a belly full of booze don't work real well. And, you know, and I've watched that by sitting in the rooms. At first, he goes along because he must. Then he discovers a way of life that he really wants to live. Where do we get our direction? Where does AA get its direction? Who runs it? This, too, is a puzzler for a friend and a newcomer. We're told that a society has no president, having no authority to govern, and no treasurer that can compel us to pay a payment of any dues, no board of directors who can cast an erring member out in the darkness. We indeed, no AA can give another a directive or enforce obedience. Our friends gasp and exclaim, it simply can't be. There must be an angle somewhere. These practical folk then read tradition too. We learn that the sole authority in AA is a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. They dutifully ask an experienced AA member if this really works. The members will always tell you yes. If you've been around a while, you know God works in a meeting. All you have to do is sit in one long enough, and you see how much time is accumulated. When this was written, I think the oldest member was maybe 15 years old. Now we have people 50, 55, 45, 60 years of continuous sobriety. That's amazing for a drunk like me. The friends mutter that looks vague. It's pretty naive of them. They commence to watch with speculative eyes and pick up a fragment of AA history, and they soon have solid facts. I was told that if I wanted to learn about how this fellowship works, I needed to get into the history. And the history I was told was in AA Comes of Age, Pass It On, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. One of the best ones, if you really want to learn, get quick history lessons, is As Bill Sees It, because there's letters that aren't in any of the literature, but in As Bill Sees It, that has helped me immensely. And the history is important, because I always think of what I was told. If I don't learn the history and learn what we're here for, we're doomed to drink again. So I was told that history is what will help me save myself not only from drinking, but show someone else a way that they don't have to drink. And that's how a loving God came through me, through a sponsor. Talks about, in the second tradition, that each group has its own flavor. And each group has, because there's so many different personalities, that flavor is what attracts different people to different meetings. There are some meetings that, and I love this, that there are some meetings that we start with reading how it works, and they read a portion out of the third chapter, more about alcoholics. There's other meetings that don't do any readings. There are some meetings that read as Bill sees it, or other AA-approved literature. There are some readings that don't have any literature readings at all. There are some meetings, and we're going to get into that much more in the fourth tradition. There are some meetings that are an hour and a half. There are some meetings that are candlelight meetings, midnight meetings, daytime meetings, and that's really about the fourth tradition, but it's also about the second tradition. Because what it tells us is that all these meetings, these flavors, because we have so many different personalities, that it'll attract certain kinds of people. And I want to end with one of my favorite things, a couple of my favorite things. It says, one of the things, you know, in our quiet time, and you know, in our peaceful time, it talks about an event that marked the period of quiet, the publication of AA's 12 Steps and 12 Traditions in 1953. This small volume is strictly a textbook which explains AA's 24 basic principles. That's a pretty interesting statement. And their application in detail with great care. We're talking about 24 basic principles now. You know, I love, and I share this, and I know it gets some people upset, but it's only my experience now, that, you know, I go into rooms and they have these 24 single words of what the principle is behind the step. If you really search our literature, it tells us that the step or the tradition is the principle we're supposed to live by. And if you really search in those traditions and those steps, you will find over 150 principles in the 12 steps alone, not just 12. You sell yourself short if you settle for 12, I was told. So, you know, the literature itself tells us that the 12 steps and the 12 traditions are the principles I have to learn to live by. And then if I stay here for the next 12 is the concept. So there are 36 spiritual principles that guide us in our living. And if we look at those 36 principles, they make the triangle. And then we have the circle for the unity, and then, you know, well, that whole thing of the AA as a whole. But our second tradition is what keeps us together more than any other tradition. Because without a loving God, and we ran on personalities, there'd be nothing but anarchy, and we'd all perish and die. So I go to the second tradition in all the time, because I believe God does express himself in a room like this, through people like you, and it's not about how much time they have or how long they've been here. God will speak through someone, as he always does, and he always will, if we relate ourselves to that. So with that, I'll be quiet for tonight.